Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Hey guys, it's Brandon from the Macro Ops Value Hive podcast. At Macro Ops, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. In my quest for understanding the metals and mining space, I have met a couple CEOs of mining companies. One of them I've had on the podcast, John Swallow, CEO of Idaho Strategic, who I think is a great operator. I love the company. And as I said in that podcast, I own a lot of their stock. Another CEO that I have the privilege of speaking to now is Doug Ramshaw of Minera Alamos, ticker symbol MAI on the Venture Exchange. I don't own shares in it now, but after listening to Doug and talking to other metals and mining investors in the space, I'm wondering why I don't own it yet. And so maybe it might be something I buy on the horizon. But I want this podcast to be a deep dive into how a mining CEO analyzes the properties, the grade, the quality of the ore, the return on investment, cash costs, ASICs, everything, and red flags and green flags. So what better person to do it than Doug Ramshaw, who's trying to build a pretty sweet company in Minera Alamos. So Doug, thanks so much for coming on. Before we dive into all that evergreen content, who are you and how'd you end up at Minera?
Thanks for having me on. I'm sure there are many people that you could have had on that are even more experienced than myself. At 52 years with 30 years in the business, I'm still learning. And I think in many ways that kind of highlights how hard it is for someone just looking at the space, because there's a lifetime of knowledge and you still could learn more thereafter. I'm a mining geologist by degree. I'll use air quotes for that when I say it, because I have 7 years of academic geology culminating in a mining geology degree. But I actually very early on in my career kind of went into my other favorite topic, which was the capital markets. I mean, I was starting to invest when I was 16 years old. And so it was a natural blend for me. I was more interested in the financial markets, but with this background in geology. So eventually, after a stint as a mining analyst very early on in my career, I realized I was doing 80-hour-plus weeks from London covering stuff in Canada. And really, it was a time zone issue that, plus also a degenerate love of talking to people and the sector that I was covering. But I was doing 80-hour weeks, and I'm thinking, that's fine if you want to work for Goldman Sachs for five years and then go to the Hamptons. But For me, I dealt with everything in one fell swoop. At 25, I just abruptly got a job offer, left the UK and moved to Canada and moved to Vancouver in 1997. And I've been in Canada now for a little over half my life in various aspects of the business, corporate development, board positions in public companies. And for the last 7+ years, working with Minera Alamos, looking to build a new gold producer. So, and still lots to learn. Hopefully today we can impart some knowledge I've gained along the way, and also highlight the difficulties of analyzing mining stocks, because everything is different. Geology is different. There are certain set kind of geological models for certain deposits, but it's funny that comment you mentioned about grade off the top. I mean, I did a very applied mining degree. We don't have a class at university that teaches you that 100 meters of whatever grade is a good hole, and 100 meters, you just don't learn that stuff. It's not, in many ways, it is just kind of absorbing over decades, you know, what does look good, what doesn't. Some results that look good from an assay point of view, ultimately fail because of metallurgical issues. Well, hang on, I had a few lectures on metallurgy when I was at university. So all of this makes it incredibly difficult for a typical investor to kind of, especially on the exploration stuff, analyze what's good, what isn't. Often the best advice I can give there is let someone else make the first 20-30%. See how something takes. Don't try to catch bottoms in this market or tops. Play the middle 60%.
And I think what you mentioned there is a perfect kind of launching ground for a generalist like myself trying to enter this space, because you've got kind of this full life cycle of, we'll call them project generators, to early stage junior developers, explorers, then those that are trying to get into production, and then you've got, you know, your mid-tiers and your large tiers. And there is that kind of lottery ticket aspect of those junior explorers where, you know, hey, one assay result or one drill result and the stock could pop, you know, 300-400%. But the more that I studied this space and tried to apply like a generalist investor framework, which means focus on cash flows, balance sheets, things like that, and maybe it's to my detriment, but I don't even want to focus on the exploration side. It just seems so much of a lottery ticket and something that I would never be able to fully understand. Is that kind of how you approach it in terms of deciding what company to eventually run?
Well, certainly, I mean, it's hard to avoid the exploration side of things, because the vast majority of companies, and we have way too many companies. So to start with, there are too many companies to pick from. The bulk of them are built trying to make that lottery ticket win. Very few actually want to put in the hard yards to get up and running as a real business that can stand the test of time, not stand the, you know, be tested by Mother Nature in the first drill season. I get the appeal. I saw it early on in my career. Companies like, a good example was Arequipa Resources. This is a stock that made a big gold discovery down in Peru in the late 90s. And the stock over an 18-month period went from 30 cents to $30, and was bought out by Barrick Gold for $900 million. Those are the returns that can happen in our space, but they are so rare and fleeting that typically they're the ones that books get written about. I've lived one of those, so I mean, I get it. And my portfolio does have some expiration exposure, but not as much as it used to, mainly because a big position I had as, which was a great exploration discovery story. I was put out of that job as the director of Great Bear Resources when Kinross bought us for $1.8 billion. And that was in 2022. And in 2016, when I joined the board, it was a $5 million market cap shell. You know, and there's always luck involved. Fortunately, I think we had an exceptional team, and an exceptional team can help against the odds. Maybe with the right people can attract capital at higher prices, so you're dealing with less dilution, which is beneficial for shareholders. But ultimately, even the greatest scientists have come up duds on projects. So maybe a good team can be kind of like going into Vegas, and a professional card counter has a slight edge against the house, just a slight, a couple of percent edge against the house. Whereas most people still will play blackjack because it's better odds than, you know, most of the rest of the casino floor, but the house will still win. So management teams that have had that success will often have the patience of their shareholders, have the ability to raise capital at higher levels to give you more of a chance to get some kind of talky outcome. But I think there is tremendous money to be made in de-risked stuff. You don't have to play the lottery ticket. So rather like maybe gold exposure on a portfolio should represent 5% of your overall holdings, I think within that subset, exploration should probably represent, you know, that 10, 20% maybe max, and really playing more established developers or production stories, where it's a lot easier for, as you said, a generalist to study, you know, money in, money out. Exploration stories, it's all about money out. Exploration is expensive. I love it. I hate the cost of it. The returns can be great, but ultimately, you know, that cost of exploration can be so diluted that at the end of the day, you know, you really don't see much of a return.
Well, so how do you then time, and maybe time is the wrong word, but how do you position yourself in these developers so that you're not drowning in dilution? Because the worst thing that can happen is you find, let's say you find a good project, a big, let's say they've got a ton of acreage, and you get in early because you think this thing's super promising, but then you get diluted, you know, 100, 200, 300% along the way. How do you avoid that if possible?
You can't even avoid that. And not to change topic, we'll get to it, but I mean, dilution is you know, an incredibly important thing to consider when making investments in any stage of company. And the example I'll give here, just to kind of frame dilution, I think as best it can be done, even the majors dilute to grow now. So when I was an analyst, Barrick in 1996, and Barrick is this blue chip gold producer. You know, the generalist money, when it does flow into the sector, inevitably will go to Barrick and Newmont and Agnico. And thank the stars, Agnico has now given them an opportunity to invest in something which, you know, to me is not kind of the dinosaur. Barrick and Newmont were, you know, these stocks to own in the 90s and early 2000s. But in many ways, I think they're dinosaurs from the perspective of where you can get your returns now on. And part of it is dilution. If you're going to, once you get a certain scale, it's not their fault. They got to a certain scale. You can't now grow meaningfully, organically. You have to grow through M&A. So Barrick in 1996, in a $400 gold environment, had a $45 share price and a $15 billion market cap, producing a fraction of what they produce today. And you fast forward 28 years, and the only reason I know these numbers is I used it on a slide in March that I was presenting in Spain. And I looked, and Barrick over a 28-year period was, you know, when gold was up 400%, was up 320% in market cap. But its shares outstanding were up 381%. That's a blue chip major that has seen almost 400% share dilution over 28 years. Surprise, surprise, the stock's off 30, 40%. In many ways, mining equities have dragged to such an extent that a lot of people ask themselves, if I want that exposure, why would I own gold equity, I'm better off owning gold. And arguably, when it comes to Barrick and Newmont, that holds water in this recent gold price rally. You saw it in Q1 where we're hitting record high gold prices in US dollar terms, and Barrick's off 5% in the quarter and Newmont's off 10%. Thankfully, Agnico is up 12%. But there is some hope here, because I think if the generalists can look below the big companies and start looking at the next tier down, those kinds of billion to 10 billion type, you know, arguably the billion to 5 or 6 billion type companies, they're still at a scale where they can grow organically. And a good example of this is what John McCluskey has done at Alamos Gold. Alamos is kind of a last 5 years success story, but really, they've been growing that thing for 25 years, from a starting out as a 25,000 ounce, 30,000 ounce a year producer to now, you know, targeting over 1 million ounces. And over the last 5 years, Alamos Gold is up 300%, whilst gold was up 75%. So there is an example of why owning the gold miner over gold makes a lot of sense. So dilution is industry-wide. And so you have to, I think you really have to be cognizant of from the start. If you're investing in an explorer, expect dilution. Potentially less dilution if it's a good management team, or buy in when the discovery is made. At least at that point, the dilution is behind you, and you can see if it's reframed as a more talky stock based on that discovery. Were they able to get a good raise done off the back of that discovery, and get some forward momentum where you can feel like the cost of capital that they're going to have to replace as part of that discovery process is going to be minimal compared to other things. Maybe you haven't been able to get it at the ground floor, but again, I go back to trying to invest in the middle 60%, not catching bottoms and tops.
Right.
Developers are tougher. They can be value traps. On paper, everything looks good. I think you have to try to determine, like, we're in a very cyclical space. And from cycle to cycle, often the developers of this cycle are projects that couldn't be sold in the last cycle. And so that team is like, okay, or they're retreads of something that didn't sell before. Well, why didn't it sell? What's going to be different about it this time? Is it just a higher commodity price? Sometimes that's enough. Yeah. But, you know, I don't think business models should be predicated on requiring a higher gold price to make them work or to make it work for someone. And because this is a cyclical business. So yes, we're in a bull market in gold right now, but at some point it's going to come off. It inevitably does. And so, you know, the problem I find with developers, I mean, the first thing I will look at is, if this project is sitting in a sub 100 million market cap company but needs $1 billion to build, well, clearly that company is not going to be doing it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not that they just won't be able to dilute to that extent. No one will give the money for something to that extent. So you've got to look at those ones and go, okay, is there an obvious buyer of it? And I don't want to invest in something where my exit strategy is someone that has to buy it. If I'm looking at it from anything other than a trade, I don't tend to look at our space as trades. I tend to look at stuff and say, okay, what is going to make this work? How are they going to achieve it? Does it check those boxes? You know, for me, okay. But I'm not playing something for a quick day trade or a quick month trade on this stuff. So, and then you've also got to look at the economic studies they put out, and you know, and they come in various forms. And obviously, the PEA is more like a scoping study. I wish they were called a scoping study rather than a preliminary economic assessment. I know it says preliminary, but it's amazing how those get trumpeted. There's huge plus minus on all those costs in something like that, which is why inevitably decent projects go on to PFS and then on to feasibility study and tighten up those costs. But ultimately what those studies will show you is a project that, you know, if it's net present value of that project with all those economic parameters that's thrown in there is close to the actual capex of the project, then again, you have to question, is it ever going to be financeable? In which case, right, where's the exit strategy? And if they say, well, someone's going to buy it, well, that acquirer has also got to look and say, well, on top of the capex that we are now on the hook for, we've got to factor in our acquisition costs, and the internal rates of return just don't support it. So developers that are focused on, you know, lower capex projects, I think, are better. We saw what happened in single asset developers recently. I know everyone says inflation is good for gold, and it typically has been the case, but it's also really bad for gold miners, where we've seen very, you know, escalating operating costs. And it's certainly bad if you happen to be unfortunate to be committed and starting to build a project during a inflationary cycle where those capex numbers can get out of control quite quickly. And as a result, we saw this with Marathon Gold and Valentine Lake and Argonaut Gold with Magino. The capex overruns were, you know, incredibly significant and couldn't be met by anything other, it's a full story arc now, of dilution and big equity dilution for their shareholders. So in both those cases, those companies were put out of their misery by, you know, Alamos buying the Magino asset and Calibre buying Marathon Gold. And so although there was kind of a happy ending in that I think those assets are now with the right companies to develop them, the equity shareholders in those companies got obliterated during that time because of, so inflation is a friend of gold. It's not necessarily inflation of gold miners and gold developers at particular points in the cycle.
Yeah, especially if the inflation on your ASICs is higher than the appreciation of the gold price. Yeah. That's when it becomes, I guess, a net negative. But you mentioned PEAs and pre-feasibility studies and, you know, definitive feasibility studies. If you put your investor hat on and you look at a project, how much do you even weigh the PEA? It sounds like, you know, you put a large parameter of, you know, values. It could be higher, it could be lower. When you get to a pre-feasibility study, what are the things that you're looking for? You mentioned kind of the NPV to CapEx. Is there some sort of ratio? Is it 2-to-1, 3-to-1 that you like to see? And then that obviously backs us into IRRs. So just walk us through how you analyze a PFS from an investment standpoint.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I think there are PEAs that can have certain sections of them done at almost PFS or feasibility study quality. And I think there's different types of deposits that, you know, like if you're looking at underground, you know, they have to go the whole yards in terms of going right through these studies. The problem with underground is the sustaining capital that's required. So it's not always that upfront capex you have to worry about. It's like, okay, if these projects have tremendous sustaining capital, and some projects they squeeze more of their initial capex into sustaining capital, well, the free cash generation from that operating cash flow is subdued as a result of that investment that's required to keep underground mines ticking along. I like to see a 2-to-1 ratio. I want there to be some margin for error, and for sure. And I tend to, trying to think the last time I invested in anything that was underground. Underground comes with a whole slew of other issues associated with it. But, you know, the reality is, we're seeing more and more discoveries. It doesn't matter whether it's copper or gold or whatever. The low-hanging fruit, the crazy exploration cycles of the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, there's a lot of the easy low-hanging fruit has been taken, or at least if they're open pit projects now, they're in, you know, let's just call them more diverse jurisdictions, more riskier jurisdictions to get that low-hanging fruit. But in tier one jurisdictions, a lot of the easy stuff has been found over the years. So you're seeing, take copper, for example. There are charts that bankers come out with that show over the last couple of decades, copper discoveries are getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And at the same time, not surprisingly, SXEW, copper production, and SXEW is a very low capital intensity kind of heap leaching of oxide copper using sulfuric acid as your reagent rather than, say, gold heap leaching, which the reagent is cyanide. Well, SXEW production, which is great for development because it's low capital intensity relative to other styles of copper production, has fallen off a cliff too. Well, not surprisingly, because all those nice green oxidized copper green rocks at surface were found in aggressive exploration cycles gone by. So it's jurisdiction is important. It's a topic that one needs to consider, just like dilution. And you know, the reality is, from my perspective, I'm less jurisdictionally challenged, but I've tended to like stuff which is more open pit. I just feel like there's less complexity in the economic studies to kind of evaluate. There's less complexity for the company itself working with its consultants to prepare those studies to factor in. The Great Bear was a good example of something which was is going to be a huge open pit, but also the structure that we were drilling there is deep and long in terms of its strike length. It's the length of the structure. So ultimately, the kind of tons per vertical meter you're going to be taking from the underground when it transitions into more of an underground mine are going to satisfy the open pit mine, but it will be de-risked off that for Kinross now, not Great Bear, but for Kinross, it will be de-risked off a phenomenal open pit first.
So what do you look for? We'll call them red flags now for open pits. So let's say you pull up a investor presentation or you're looking to expand Minera Alamos's properties and you're trying to find another mine and an open pit comes across your desk. What are some immediate red flags that kind of spark your antenna? You're like, nope, I don't want to do this.
Well, I think you really need to have a good handle on metallurgy. I actually think a lot of exploration companies should hire a decent metallurgist very early on to understand what the mineralogy is of that they're drilling, because there can be red flags in metallurgy right from the outset. Jurisdictionally, I mean, there are parts of, say, look at Arizona has some great open pits, but it also has parts of Arizona where you'd never get an open pit mine permitted. So understanding the environmental sensitivities of where you're looking to operate, water management is a global issue. Canada, we have plenty of water, but a lot of jurisdictions, it's going to be problematic. And there is huge NIMBYism with mining. And so you need to be aware that even if locals want mines, Mexico is a good example. It's like lots of people work either directly in Mexico with or get the indirect benefit of mining and like it. Quite often it's NGOs from countries, you know, elsewhere that want to stop this stuff. And if they actually realize the harm they're doing to local communities that want these mines, but they don't care. So NIMBYism or NGO back stuff, one has to try to be aware of the sensitivities of where a company is trying to drill off something or build something, because those will over trump however good the geology is, however good the team is, it's amazing the force and power. And I think our industry doesn't do a good job of pushing back and showing that, you know, we can be responsible in how we extract our metals that can ultimately actually help. Like, you know, the reality is the mining industry still employs 19th century technology. We keep talking about disrupting things, and it's true, you can have EV mining fleets and all this other stuff too. But the reality is we're still largely digging big holes in the ground. And so the mining industry, and especially copper, you know, most of the world's copper comes from big open pits, big holes in the ground. And can they be done responsibly? Yes, as much as a big hole in the ground can be a responsibly done activity. But the reality is, if you're going to stop the development of these, then you're going to stop the development of the very mines that can give you the building blocks for technological change that can help both societal change and ultimately climate change. And it's going to require a little bit of a scar on the earth done responsibly or we stagnate in our technological advancements. So I think the industry doesn't do a good enough job of pushing back. In fact, actually, the industry does the opposite. I had a friend of mine, and I wish I could give him credit. So I forgot who it was, but he told me this, so I won't take credit for it. And I will just say some random friend of mine once mentioned, the mining industry can't help but show pictures of its holes in the ground in its presentations, on its slideshows and whatever. And he made the comment, the meat industry never shows pictures of abattoirs. And I thought it was so on point. And I know when at the end of my career, what I want to do is give back to a sector that's given a tremendous amount to me. And that's to help educate and to help, because you know, take a city like, look, for whatever reason, mining gets this bad rap. It's, even though it can be very beneficial for the world, it gets this bad rap. And what I don't get is we don't care when we're asphalting, like take Phoenix in the late 90s, early 2000s, fastest growing city in, I think, in the States.
Yep.
And that growth came from asphalting over the desert down there. You know, as more and more subdivisions were built, as Phoenix spread out, no one seems to have the same concerns when it comes to urban development. But the very mines that support that urban development, that's the issue. And at some point, I kind of want to pull up the Google map timeline of satellite images, which show the growth of Phoenix and look at the area that it grew over. And then compare the mining footprints during that same period around the world. And that's just one city. You know, when we're building new Walmarts and we're asphalting over whatever, there's not the same issue. Now, is that because the mining industry's made mistakes? Well, yeah, we've had our mine disasters and this, that, what. But I think for the overall good that the industry actually does in providing these very metals, which are the building blocks of everything around us, it seems like it gets a harder rap. So if that's the case, what can we do as an industry to show we can do things better, or we are doing things better? And I don't think we do a good enough job in that regard.
And it makes, to me, it makes logical sense when you have a large portion of people that are pushing for electrification and EVs and electric cars and offshore wind turbines and things like that. But if you're also trying to ban the ingredients that you need to make those things, then it starts to become a little bit confusing and a little bit illogical. And it brings me to a question I wanted to ask you, which is, why did you end up trying to build a gold company versus a copper, a lithium, cobalt? Like, why did you decide gold versus something else?
Yeah. It was the opportunity to work with an industry legend, actually. So in 2017, there was a company called Corex Gold. Now, the head of our technical was a guy called Chester Miller. He was in his late 80s at the time. I'm happy to say he emailed me the other day, and he's still alive and well at about 95. He's in the Canadian Mining Hall of Fame, and which is a distant second to our Hockey Hall of Fame, but still, it's got some illustrious people in it, and Chester's one of them. I mentioned earlier kind of open pit, a lot of open pit mining, early days in Nevada and everything else was open pit heap leach, using cyanide. Never, he was a pioneer, he was a grandfather of open pit heap leach. So I had an opportunity to work with him, because the incumbent management of Corex were kind of, you know, good friends of mine, but they weren't mining people like me, say, that had done a degree. They were people that, like, what I turned into, which was someone that liked the capital markets. But, you know, so they built people around their interest in making money in the capital markets. But they'd neglected. So I was parachuted in to kind of save this company, clean it up, fix it, however you want to describe that. And I saw day one onto the job, incredible neglect, an interesting asset, but an incredible neglect of big shareholders and our technical team. And I remember Chester on my, and he was the guy that, like, this great appeal to go and work with him. But day one on the job, I think he thought I was just a proxy for the previous management team. So he came at me hard. At 89, he came at me hard. I felt like I was a kid being stuffed into a locker on his first day at school by a guy 4 grades higher. And I told him, I said, Chester, back off. I can't fix all this in day one. I can't do it in week one or month one. I need 3 months. Give me 3 months to show some positive change in the direction of things. And fortunately, in the first month of the job, I met Darren Kernaghan, the CEO and president of Minera Alamos. And he'd always coveted the asset that we had. And I told him, well, there's a new sheriff in town. He had another asset in his company, gold as well, that needed a little bit more capex. And Santana in Corex was a very cheap initial build just to get things up and running, where you could look and go, okay, a little easier to take a bit of debt on for project two if you're up and running on project number one. And so we slammed the companies together kind of on a merger of equals 50-50 basis in early 2018. Prior to that, I'd been working on something which was lead and zinc in Australia. I'm kind of commodity agnostic. When I was an analyst, I covered just about everything but uranium. So kind of commodity agnostic, what got me into the predecessor of Minera was actually a person, the opportunity to work, even though he was really hard to work with, an industry legend like Chester.
And so when you merged these two companies, what was the plan after that? Was it to build, like, did you have the strategy of, like, we just want low cost mines and we want to start one, and we want to scale that, use the cash flow to get to number two? And then you mentioned the decision to use a little debt. Obviously, that is also a decision not to dilute as much, because you've got kind of two sources of capital there. And so walk me through kind of that scenario and how you thought about long-term planning, because, you know, the best investments in this space, you know, obviously you've got your exploration that can be, you know, 10, 20 baggers, but you can also buy these producers that start small, that scale, and that keep growing production to become large scale operators.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I looked at it, I said at the time it was a $50 million merger. I mean, we were two 25 million market cap companies. And I said earlier that we need less companies. It was the right fit. A lot of people said this is the kind of M&A that should happen in this space. But to me, it felt like 1 + 1 = 5. And honestly, if someone tells me a merger is 1 + 1 = 3, ultimately it's 1 + 1 = 2.25. You know, you need that deal, the combination of assets and teams to kind of if you're putting two things together, yeah, 1 + 1 = 5. And I mean, arguably in that hot market of 2020, a few years later, when the whole sector got ahead of itself, and we were no exception to that, you know, that 1 + 1 = 5 happened. I mean, Monero went from a 50 million market cap up to just around 300 million. We're about half of that now. I love the idea of building something real in a sector that is full of smoke and mirrors. And the combination of assets made a lot of sense. You know, the second asset that was already in Monero, Alamos, had kind of a $26 million capex to it, but Santana we felt could be built for $10 million. I looked at the team, they'd done it before. The team that, you know, has worked with Darren for 14 years now down in Mexico had great success employing this exact strategy at a mine they built in Durango, again, in northern Mexico, where we tend to focus. That was built in, 2007-08. They built a 25,000-ounce-a-year gold mine for around $7 million U.S. in capex.
Oh, my God.
With the idea that, and off a very modest resource, like 300,000-ounce resource. So size isn't everything, because what they saw was a resource that could grow,
right?
But it made more sense to grow it from the cash flow from an operation than just to drill it completely out and then scale a mine around it. An open pit heap leach is modular to expand. So that mine, ultimately, in 2 years, they grew it from 25,000 ounces a year. It was heading to 75,000 ounces a year when Argonaut Gold bought them for $130 million. And it's just come to the end of its life now in like 2024. It had peak production years of around 120,000 ounces annually. And that all from a little mine that our team built for $7 million, and then it just got expanded out of cash flow. It made so much sense to me, and it's funny because it's my first job out of university. Before I became an analyst, I was an assistant editor at the Mining Journal in London, and so I was young and, you know, full of, you know, love for the sector and interest for the sector and
hopes and dreams.
23, 24, I was writing about these Australian junior miners, and they deserve to have miners. And junior companies in Vancouver never really want to build. They want to build a stock and then find someone to buy their paper off. But these junior miners were in Australia were doing this same kind of bootstrapped approach, which as a 23, 24-year-old, I thought, well, that's very smart. You know, they take something which is maybe only 150,000 or 200,000 ounces, and they build a 40 or 50,000 ounce mine around it and then grow it out of cash flow. And I thought that then that was smart, and I'm living that now. Don't get me wrong, it comes with its trials and tribulations.
Of course.
Building, you know, maybe that's why people don't want it. They're different. The risks are different. I'd rather have the tests and trials and good teams find ways to work through those problems than, you know, a good team. If Mother Nature comes up zeros on a drill hole, a good team can't change those numbers. So right. I'd rather have a battle with kind of, you know, engineering issues or whatever it might be, you know, drought conditions or a changing permitting environment than, you know, crossing my fingers when I'm drilling a hole and hoping this has got to be the one to hit, or, you know, we're going back to the market to dilute our shareholders again.
And so you start, let's say you have this 300,000 ounce deposit, which, you know, you consider moderate. And I've got like a tangent question on like how you specifically define moderate, small, and large resources, but we'll table that. So you've got this 300,000 ounce deposit, maybe get, you know, you start out 25, 30, 40,000 ounces a year. And again, this might be a stupid question, but when you go into that and you say, okay, we're going to scale with the cash flow from these initial 25, 40 ounces, 40,000 ounces, do you have like the PEA and the PFS data to know that you can scale out? Or is it, we know that this is here and we've got, you know, decent confidence that we can explore kind of greenfield territory after that and hope, I mean, hope sounds like, you know, obviously a lottery ticket, but like hope that there's more resource out there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's always, so if we're looking at something, it can be in the 300,000 to 500,000 ounce range, but we've got to have meaningful signs of whether, you know, where we can see it go to north of 1 million, 1.5 million ounces. Doesn't mean they all will, but we've, you know, and some of that's just brownfields extensions that aren't part of the initial study. Some of it is greenfield prospectivity where we've already got some data to kind of support it. So they vary. But you don't go through all the hard, you know, the hard yards of permitting just to build something that gets mined out in 6 years, and now you've got to start that whole process again somewhere else. So you want to be able to grow something. So these deposits start small. Absolutely, they're on the lower end.
Yeah.
But they can, our goal is to make sure that they are all, you know, 1.5 million ounce type deposits in time, supported okay. by exploration efforts, funded by cash flow rather than by shareholders effectively. And that's always been the goal. So we will never be an industry leader in terms of the size of our deposits or, but where I think, I used to say we had this kind of industry leading low capital intensity. And then I thought, well, I'm saying that, I'm throwing it around like it's fact. You know, maybe I should, and I'm pretty sure it's right, but maybe I should check. And I asked our bankers to come up with this table to, and the typical gold mine is anywhere between $1,600 to 1,800 an ounce. And that's CapEx divided by their annual production profile, defining capital intensity, mm-hmm. to maybe $3,000 an ounce. And our projects were in their $400, $500, $800 ounce level and right at the far end of that curve. That's great because it means we've been very insulated from inflationary pressures. Sometimes permitting can take longer. But that doesn't have the same, that might test one's patience and one's resolve, but it doesn't test the balance sheet the same way as having a project being built that is far more sensitive to inflationary pressures. A banker at one of the big banks in Canada said to me a few years ago, he said, well, your next two projects, 2 and 3 of yours, what's the combined CapEx? And this was where companies were seeing $100-200 million blowouts at an existing, you know, project they're developing, just a right. single asset. And I said, well, the combined of the next two, probably about $60 million US. So he said, so a 30% increase on yours is $20 million. And I go, yeah, I mean, it's not much. It's annoying because you don't want to spend any money unnecessarily, but yeah, it doesn't create that huge funding shortfall that decimated shareholders and a lot of other companies, especially if you've got a first operation that can is up and running, can support those. And so to me, it's, you know, scale. We have a portfolio of three assets in a base case can generate 150,000 ounce a year production profile, and maybe on an upside case over 200,000 ounces. I would prefer to build that profile sequentially from these assets and limit the risks on that come at the expense of shareholders than say having a single asset that's much bigger that can scale to being a 200,000 ounce mine, but get you into all manner of other problems with it, and have bigger capex that's having to be paid back for longer and the like. All those things I think can work against shareholders, and I think our business plan was always smart. These inflationary times have made it smarter. As I say, we've been working through our own issues, but again, they're more an issue of time rather than cost. And I'll always take that as a big shareholder myself.
Yeah,
you know, I will always take a little bit of time over. Oh no, we've got to somehow come up with $40 or $50 million we weren't anticipating, because that's going to dilute me like all my other shareholders. So we've avoided that, and I'm proud to say.
I think it just makes sense. And again, like, I'm someone that was very much a generalist that does not have this, you know, single industry exposure. Like I'm still learning, and I'll always keep learning. But this idea of you start small, you scale, and you grow from the profits you generate from your operations, not from dilution or from excessive debt. I think that model, the reason why I like it is because it transcends just the mining industry. That model works for a consumer product good selling widget one, and they say, okay, we've got widget one. Let's use the gross profit from widget one to reinvest into more if it's successful. And if not, then we'll kill the project and we'll move on to widget two. And like part of my, I guess, job or kind of duty that I've assumed here is trying to break down the barriers for generalist investors to help better understand the mining industry in a business model with a mental model that makes sense. And like Mineral Alamos, that story makes sense because that's the same story as, you know, the one I invested in Idaho Strategic, where it's you start small, you grow from 5,000 to hopefully 20,000 ounces, you use the cash flow to explore and expand your resource, and you just keep moving the ball forward without diluting shares. So like that stuff just, it just clicks to me, and it makes me wonder why other smaller producers that are trying to scale to mid-tier don't employ that same strategy, because they would reach a much wider investor base that would be more readily available to understand it.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have enough teams that want to build in our sector. I mean, there are good teams out there doing good work on their projects. Our ones in Mexico are easy to modularly expand. These open pit heap leach projects certainly lend themselves to that. So that helps. The cost structure in Mexico helps. The team's experience of doing this in Mexico helps. I think the issues that face our sector are that we don't have enough people that want to build these things. We also have almost a desire for scale. I think, you know, you're often heard M&A is good because you scale up, the market rewards scale. I think the problem with our sector has been, and you're kind of seeing it now, I mean, some of those data points I gave on Barrick and Newmont earlier, you know, record high US dollar prices, but falling 5% and 10% respectively in Q1. What a message that sends to generalists. I think that this desire to be big, which most people want, like our biggest shareholders are generalists, and they get it exactly the way you do. And you know, I want to run this business like if I opened up a coffee shop on a corner, and if I have to make sure I'm making money at any time of the year. The mining industry, for whatever reason, if things aren't making money, you go to the market, you dilute the shareholders, you continue to survive. In any other industry, you know, eventually the banks say no. Last year, $1,800, $2,000 gold, that's a very healthy gold price. I think it's exposed how unhealthy our sector is. That really, you've got a sector predicated on requiring higher gold prices to, you know, to make things work. That's not the sign of a healthy sector. It's one of the reasons I said earlier, you know, those billion to, you know, the Calibers, the Westones, the Alamos, gold, you know, to me are where the first bigger generalist money should flow to. Now, a lot of value is already there. And so, you know, below those, where are the ones for people to perhaps get more torque in a company's earlier stages of life, you know, is where it trickles down from there. But I don't know if it should be destined for the big boys. But those were healthy gold prices. And we've kind of exposed how unhealthy the sector is. Our business model was built in a $1,300 gold environment to work in a $1,300 gold environment. You know, you want to be able to capture a moving gold price, not require a gold price to allow you to breathe again and, you know, do the next M&A deal, which then dilutes shareholders or whatever. And so these are very healthy gold prices we have right now. Monero has demonstrated when we've been producing gold, it's come at very high margins. Margins is an interesting one because I had someone at a big conference recently. They were looking at our economic study for the mine we're permitting right now, Cerro de Oro.
Yeah.
The phenomenal, it's a step change for the company. I mean, Santana is kind of this $10 million build we did in the middle of the pandemic, built on budget, little behind schedule because of the pandemic, but and it's had its trials and tribulations, and not to use excuses, a lot of things one couldn't foresee and were somewhat out of our control, but you know, we've kind of worked through those. When it's been producing a very, very good margin on it, but it's small, it's served its purpose, it's allowing us to take some debt on to build project number two, which again is very small. It's a less than $30 million capex for a 60,000 ounce a year mine, sub $900 cost. So,
it's crazy.
You know, the numbers get cartoonish on what free cash it will generate when it's built, because the sustaining capital on that is running at less than $2 million a year. So your operating cash flow is going to be largely free cash generating, which is fantastic for reinvesting in the business. This person was looking at the economic study and he didn't like the grade. I mean, this is basically a dirt moving exercise at surface, sub 0.4 of a gram. And he goes, yeah, I don't like that grade. And I said, okay, so you're a high grade person. That's fine. But just so you know, what you should fixate on is what the margin is, not whether it's the input grade is low right. or high. Those high grade things that you like often, almost always underground mines. And for all those comments we were talking about earlier about, you know, the problems of underground mines and the higher cost structure that can come with them and the geotechnical issues and stuff, it's like they can eat, and the higher capex, that all eats into your free cash generation. And for me, you know, what I love about the foundation we're building right now, we're such good stewards of capital because, again, when you're a big shareholder yourself, that capital, your shareholder's capital is yours too. Like for me, our biggest challenge will be when Cerro de Oro is permitted, we have the funding package already there, so ready to go. There's going to be no nasty surprise for shareholders because we haven't thought ahead about how we're going to fund this. And now suddenly, hey, everyone, great news, we got permits. And 2 weeks later, you know, you've just stuffed all your shareholders with some deeply discounted financing because you didn't think ahead. You know, that one is going to generate so much free cash that our biggest challenge would be, how can we efficiently deploy that capital back into the business? Well, we certainly can. We've got the assets to do it, but efficiently, you know, just spending, because you don't want it to build up on your books. So, I mean, I have huge aspirations. And one of the reasons I will always say, when people say, why do you own 9 million shares of the company? Why do you keep buying? It's like, because I think we have a business model that in due course will have to return capital to shareholders. Now, I know some people hate dividends. I love the concept of dividends. You know,
I love the concept, but like, I guess I would be, if I had to choose, I would choose buybacks.
Yeah. And so buybacks don't, so the way I look at it
is say
we have $40 million of cash generated in a year, US, which is almost half our market cap right now. You know, there's probably $20 million you can reinvest into the business efficiently. There's probably 10 that you build up on the balance sheet, and there's probably 10 you want to return to shareholders. Now, in higher gold price environments, that extra 10 can increase. And what I would like to do is more of a hybrid, because some people, for tax reasons, prefer buybacks over dividends. Yeah. Some people don't. The concept of a dividend, I think, is important for demonstrating to the market that your dividend is sustainable. The last thing you want is to have a dividend and only to cut it. So, you know, you're showing a sustainable strengthening of the balance sheet that supports a dividend payment. And over a certain threshold, maybe you hybrid and say, oh, the next 5 million after the 10 that you distribute as dividends is buybacks. And then if there's, so you can have a hybrid formula, which a number of companies employ, and I think it's the right way of kind of doing both. But for me, $10 million, maybe a couple of cents a share dividend is more. I would be making more from my dividends than I do salary from the company. Yeah. You know, and when I think about it, I mean, you're a young father. I'm an old but new father. And there's going to come a point in time that, despite the fact I love this sector, 5-6 years from now, I'm going to want to make sure I'm putting my time into my kids, and you know, the company's built to a certain point where I can give up the day job, so to speak, but through a sustainable dividend policy, I'm not losing any kind of pay. I'm just now reaping the rewards of buying the stock that I did all those years before. So I think a hybrid at some point, I hope, is in our future, because you just, what you don't want, and I have a lot of shareholders that say, well, you know, what if someone, you know, would you entertain a buyout? And, you know, and it's like, well, if we're being bought out, it's not because we've got the biggest assets in the world. So what we're probably being bought out for is our assets are actually really good at making money. And if a company's buying us for that, it's because they need our money. And what does that say about their current position? So is that a good outcome for our shareholders? Or is it actually better to say, if we go through all the hard yards to build this foundation right now, isn't the real fun and reward and challenge now saying, well, can we be one of those companies that has grown into a $3-4 billion company over the last couple of decades? And that's a real legacy to leave in the space. Calibre is a good example I use only because sometimes I'm asked, what's a comparable for Monero? And I don't know if I can actually put my finger on one, not in the Canadian markets. But I would say that probably Monero is where Calibre was six, seven years ago. Calibre's now close to $1.5 billion company, and you know, on its way to a 500,000 ounce a year producer, got into the GDX, you know, able to do big bought deals at will. You know, it's I would like all of those aspects, except for the fact that, you know, if our foundation is right, we don't need to do the big bought deals. So everything about our business model is to avoid dilution, and I think we've done a good job of it. So, but yeah, maybe we're Calibre like six plus years ago.
And going back to that discussion you had earlier, where you've got a large shareholder or someone that wanted to be a large shareholder that didn't like the grade. One thing I always want to know, and again, as someone coming into the space totally green, is how do you rank the importance of certain variables in a mine, in a producer, in a project? And so what I mean by that is, let's say you've got IRR, you've got the NPV to CapEx, you've got the resource amount, the annual production, the grade per ton, and then you've also got the margins, right? Your ASICs. How do you rank those? Like, which one is most important? Which one do you start with? And because that's where I get lost. It's like, okay, this has low ASICs, but it's got a lot of, you know, it's got bad grade. And then the other thing is, like, if it's got high grade, shouldn't it have low ASICs because you have more, you know, mineral per ton of ore? And so, like, these are the questions that, you know, swirl in my head when I look at all these different mining stocks.
Yeah, I mean, I like high IRR projects. I want capital in, capital out, and payback of that capital is important. I mean, for some of the companies that survive CapEx overruns at the expense of their shareholders, I mean, they've had to take on more debt, and, you know, they're going to be paying back for many more years than they otherwise would have done. So I want high IRR projects. They may be... say in a sector that wants scale, you know, you don't get scale in high IRRs. But again, we're kind of counter to that thought base in the sector that, you know, for us, these are projects that are, I mean, take Cerro de Oro. We ran that economic model, the PEA for it, at $1,600 gold, and it had a plus 100% IRR. Yeah. You know, it's the numbers get cartoonish if you plug in, you know, current gold prices. But we won't, because it's more important to show that your project can be resilient wherever the overall curve is on the commodity price. So, you know, I want high IRRs. That typically means, you know, you're looking at smaller projects, but smaller projects also then come with low capex. And if you can get the blend of these low capex projects with low ASIC, like that was sub 900 ASIC life of mine. I think first 3 or 4 years are sub 800 ASIC. You know, for me, it's about mining gold that makes sense and makes money. And it's all about cash generation at the end of the day. And then what you can do with that cash to grow the next iteration of the company. Monero right now, these assets, this is iteration one of Monero. I hope over the next couple of decades, long after I've gone, I'm seeing what smart people have done to create iteration three of Monero. I think I will preside over iteration two, but for it to stand the test of time. But starting off with assets that are about generating the very cash to support that growth of the business. You know, I mentioned our biggest shareholders, biggest institutional ones are generalists, and that, you know, I like the generalist because, and I like to think like a generalist, because, and in many ways, I think, although our business model happens to not be that coffee shop, it's a gold mining company. It defines probably better long-term kind of fiscal principles to grow a company. And I want to build something which is both a growth and a value stock. Maybe because of our growth, we lose the value denomination there. But, you know, ultimately, you know, I think that's where over this next little while, we can be a real sweet spot in terms of an entry. Teams or investors just have to believe that we can execute on what's a smart business plan. The team's done it before, so it's the reason I put $3 million in myself, is an absolute endorsement of the team we have to actually execute on the plan. It's great having a plan that makes sense, but if you don't have the right team, and I always say to people that my personal backing of this company is the best possible way of stating just what my belief is in the team, because they're the ones doing the hard yards. I get to talk about the company to investors and deal on the capital market side. I rarely get my hands dirty in the geology anymore, because after 7 years of academic geology and then going on the capital markets, I considered myself more dangerous in that area. And I leave the people who've been doing it for a living for 30 years to make those decisions. But,
and we've touched on the price of gold. It's, you know, $2,300 today as of this recording. And I think in some of your studies or your economic assessments, you're assuming like $1,600 gold, which is just kind of wild at the IRRs that you can get even at those prices. And so when you look beyond, let's say you're expanding, you get to that 80 to 100,000 ounce production level, and now you're looking to add even more. So you've got a ton of cash flow, you're growing. When you go to add resources, how do you think about your gold price assumptions?
I mean, I think we'll still, like when we, in 2018 or 19, when we did the PEA for La Fortuna, I mean, we ran that at 1250. Arguably, we should be running, redoing that at some point at a higher prices, but people can do the math and realize. And yes, there's been some inflation on those cost pressures, but still nothing major. And then when Cerro de Oro came along, I think gold was around 1800 and 16 seemed in line with long-term consensus forecasts. I think long-term consensus forecasts now are a few hundred dollars higher than that. Yeah, it's funny, you'll see analysts throughout the sector, metals analysts, and they'll have their 2-3 year hike, up in context with the current market. But their long-term price might still be 1800, even though they're spiking up to 24, 25. And it's like, and it's true to some extent, you can't look too far out. So this isn't, I'm sure some people think this is gold's day and destiny, and you see all these headlines, gold to $3,000 and $5,000 an ounce. Sure, there's a breaking of the monetary system right now, but I don't necessarily, I think you still have to take a more conservative viewpoint into the future, because again, this is building our coffee shop that's meant to be able to make money anytime in the coffee cycle. And so you have to look at the past and go, there is a volatility in the gold price, and you want to ensure that your projects can withstand that volatility. Maybe we'd run a new model at 1800 now against a $2,300 gold price with what the forecast is moving forward. But we tend to look and tend to think on a long-term perspective of applying some conservatism to these numbers, which is what we did at Cerro de Oro, and I'm sure what we do on any future project.
And all of that makes sense. And one of the reasons, I bring that up is, if we look out over the future, one of the reasons that I became interested in your stock is just the drawdown from the 2020 highs to today. It's about 60%. And to me, it's confusing, because on one hand, the story makes sense. I'm sure it's confusing for you as the owner operator of this thing, but what would the general investment, like, what are they missing? And are there concerns, that 60% drawdown, are they valid? I know there's this huge overhang of Mexican permitting and Mexican geopolitics, which I'm sure weighs on the stock. But, what do you think is kind of that missing piece for them?
Well, if we look back at 2020 and that kind of post-COVID May through September market, most stuff got ahead of itself. So when I look at our highs in the fall of 2020, we were right around 70 cents, kind of, a little over double from where we are now, Canadian. I mean, that was also a market where we saw Agnico over $100 a share, and that's a phenomenal company. Everything got into a bit of a heightened frenzy back then, and we were no exception. It bothered, to some extent, it bothered me, because what am I, we were ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
But am I meant to, put my feet up and not talk about the company and the potential and everything? I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't. So some of that drawdown, I think, was the market frothiness coming off the sector. The way I would say 70 to 60 cents was sort of, maybe even to 55, 60 was the frothiness coming off the sector. I think 55 down to, 40 was operationally, we made some tough decisions. I would do them again. No one, if you're an explorer and you've got 7 rigs, you expand your drills to 7 rigs, and your shareholders love it because, like, all those assay results coming through. And then if you have to cut because of budgets or decisions or geology, you cut those rigs from 7 down to 1 or kill a drill program, shareholders hate that. Yeah. Likewise, as a producer, if you're ramping up production and then you're hit with a regional drought that was very significant in northern Mexico and southern California, there were all those pictures of Lake Mead drying up. It was very, regional water availability was very problematic, and we could have listened to what the market wanted and tried to push production. Instead, we would have ended up blowing a giant hole in our balance sheet.
Yeah.
We figured it was better to take the licks, scale back production. No one wanted to see that. No one wanted to hear that, but it was the right decision. We scaled production back to, almost a care and maintenance residual kind of mining rate. And we're increasing that again now this year with plans we announced in February and April. But it also allowed us to protect the balance sheet, which now allows us to expand things again without shareholder dilution.
Right.
When you spend money, it's gone. So it's got to be replaced either through the operation or an equity raise. But if you protect your money, it's there for when you can utilize it. So throughout this period, we've been sitting at roughly 20 million in working capital, you know, and, you know, 10 to 15 million in cash. And I've seen lots of companies that would blow up because they wouldn't listen to, you know, they would listen to the street. They would listen to what their shareholders or the bankers or whoever wanted, rather than realizing that that heartbeat of the project, of the asset, we know better than anyone else. Right. So we should go with where our heart and where that heart rate of the project is leading us. As a result, you know, we're off 50% roughly from that kind of frothy, you know, post-frothy period in the market. Am I happy with it? Absolutely not. My cost base is literally 3 cents below, 3 or 4 cents below where we're trading on my 9+ million shares. And our shareholders, I know a great many of them that have taken their hits, but they believe in the business model. They believe in the team, and so they're sticking with it. Now, 2023 was a year we'd like to put in the rearview mirror. 2024 is the year to reward that loyalty and patience of our shareholders, and we've got the plans in place now to do precisely that. And it was making tough decisions, but I've seen a lot of companies that have had 90+% drawdowns in their stock price during these last few years. So to make their shareholder base largely whole, they need to 10 bag from the bottom. Yeah. We're in this space to make our 10 bags. We don't need 10 baggers to just get whole.
Yeah.
For us,
that's depressing.
A double from here, which is, you know, absolutely attainable through just execution on the existing assets, not needing an exploration hole hit or a gold price move. The gold price could fall and we execute, the stock can get back. And my first job, iteration one in Monero, is to make sure our shareholders are whole. And then as we build out from there, we're making the money. And, you know, that's what 2024 is about.
The last thing I want to discuss is the topic of promotion and marketing the stock. And the reason I want to is because the mining industry in particular has a troubled connection or a troubled ability to attract low cost capital. And so this is, you know, it's been well documented. Like a lot of banks are just deciding, we don't want anything to do with, you know, air quotes, dirty mining. We're not going to lend to you. Or royalty companies are going to take, you know, 1.5, 3% net smelter rates off the top. And it's just hard to get loans, hard to get financing. And so really the only option is you either take on, you know, high cost debt, 12, 15%, or you dilute. But if I look at a company and I look at a mining CEO and their responsibilities, part of it is kind of what I look at when I see Robert Friedland is, they like, part of that repertoire is your ability to tell the story of your company, to get shareholders to commit capital so that you can fund what you want to do. And you don't have to be at the, you know, at the mercy of banks. And so how do you view that role of promoting your company without promoting the stock? Because I know that that's hard to do. And I know that I know that the mining industry is swarming with people, like you said, that are just trying to build a stock and not build a company. And so how do you manage that potential gray area?
Yeah, I mean, promotion, I like to think of it as marketing, but I mean, they're one and the same. It's semantics. There's a way of doing things. Darren builds mines with incredible low capital intensity, and I feel like I need to honor that work by not then saying, oh, thanks for all those savings. I've got all this extra cash to promote the company. I like to approach marketing the same way as we do mine building, with trying to get as much for as little as possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, on Twitter, Twitter's not cost the company anything. But I bet you 10% of our stock is owned by people that came across this company through Twitter, and it was $0 at some time. It's not the Monero Alamos account that people follow for Monero stuff. It's my account.
Yeah.
But I don't talk Monero all the time. I just try to be genuine, and like I say with anyone who meets me in real life will realize that I'm just the same as my handle on Twitter, you know, I just with less gifts. And I've been really busy the last little while, so I haven't been posting as much, but it's not just all about Monero, and it shouldn't, anyone approaching Twitter, it shouldn't be all about that. It should be, again, you know, trying to, you know, give positive opinions on and information on the sector at large. So we only spend, you know, $300,000 a year. And when we were a 300 million market cap company, or 150, it's the same, maybe 300,000 on that. And part of it is how we do a lot of the right, a lot of small things right. That's what built into loyalty and from our shareholder base. I remember early on in my career, someone said, if you raise money at 10 cents, you have to find people to buy their paper off them at 10 cents when you're raising money at 20. And I thought, that seems so incredibly inefficient. Why not give a reason for the person who owns the stock at 10 cents to hold at 20 and hold at 30?
Right.
You make your life a lot easier in that regard. And why are you treating shareholders as disposable? Give them a reason to hang on. So, you know, lots of little things. I mean, the business model is smart, but that's only part of it. Our fiscal responsibility, which I wish governments showed more of, is paramount to us. It does mean shareholders know that the dilution factor is not major with us. It's things like, we don't pay ourselves anywhere near industry standard rates. I think once we're generating cash flow, we're probably all overdue a pay raise, but it shouldn't happen until we're at that point where the company is doing well enough to support it. We set incentive stock options at like all-time highs, where we tied their vesting. You often see stock options set, the maximum number that can be set at the lowest possible price immediately vest. Whereas, like, that's not alignment with your shareholders.
Yeah.
Not at all. And so we set about 7.5 million options at 72 cents, and we tied their vesting. They have a 5-year life. Their vesting was tied to meaningful production goals. So for every 50,000 ounces of production, 25% will vest. Well, I can say right now that maybe 50% of those will vest. By the time 2026 comes around, next year, we might have crested the 100,000 ounce. In 2026, the year after next, we might have crested 100,000 ounces. So 50% of those options disappear. Rightfully so. If we can't deliver, then we shouldn't be rewarded, even if our shareholders didn't see what they bought in for.
Right.
Someone once told me, are you trying to set a new trend in the industry? And I laughed as they were asking me the question, because you're not going to change something so ingrained in our space.
Yeah.
You know, but it does. So, but just because, you know, you're not going to win medals for it, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't do the right thing. And that was proper alignment with our shareholders.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, for me, Monero, I can probably sum up by saying it, like, our industry does a lot of good things. It does a tremendous amount of bad things. And I used to get on the soapbox and talk about all the bad stuff our sector does. And instead I thought, why don't we build a company that tries to do things the right way, the shareholder way? And if there's one legacy I have from the sector, wherever our market cap ultimately is, when I want to spend more time with my kids and my family, the legacy of how we built Monero is as important to me as the value we've created for our shareholders.
Hmm. I think that's a great place to end. I think it's a fantastic kind of synopsis of what you're trying to do, how you're trying to do it, and how you think about the plan that you have in place. And so if people want to learn more about Manera Alamos and about you, where can they go to find you and your company?
Well, ManeraAlamos.com is the website. At the bottom of every press release, there's my cell phone number and my personal email address. Personal cell, personal email. Happy to always address any questions. If I can't pick up a phone immediately, I'll always give a response within 24 hours. On Twitter, I'm at Doug Can. I once had a friend create a parody account, which was at Doug Cannot. Doug Can comes from me moving to Canada, and all my handles back in the day were Doug and then C-A-N after. I think it's very important for executives to be available. And it would not change if we were a billion-dollar company. My bandwidth might change a little, but I'm never going to forget the people that got us to that point. And they will always be people that should feel free to want to talk to me. In fact, I would, regardless of Manera, I mean, any shareholder thinking about investing in any company, you should reach out to management. It's a great test. Management's not interested in returning your call, then maybe they're not interested in you putting your after-tax dollars into their company. I think that there's a certain amount of respect that we should be paying to people thinking about or are shareholders of our companies. We do serve at their pleasure every year with their vote to AGMs, and they deserve to have a voice, and they deserve to vent their frustrations. Or sometimes I get the most wonderful emails and phone calls from people that I know. They know that during trials and tribulations, they recognize we're doing everything we can to support them as shareholders. So those are the easiest ways to get hold of me or to find out more information about the company, Brandon.
And the other great thing about it too is if you can connect with these CEOs like yourself or someone like John Swallow at IDR, is you can bounce other companies off of them and get their opinion and say, hey, like, I just ran across this company. Like, here's their feasibility study. Like, what are your thoughts? Like, do you know the management team? Do you know these guys? Do you know the project? And I've learned so much just from asking, basic questions to mining CEOs and just getting a read on how they think, and then seeing, okay, is what they're saying, does it track with how I thought initially? And it really helps a generalist kind of gauge their progress in assessing different mining opportunities. So that's just another added benefit.
For sure.
Well, Doug, this has been awesome. I'm super excited to release it. I think people that either are, Manera shareholders or even just generalists or other mining enthusiasts that don't even know about your company, I think they're really going to enjoy this podcast. And I wish the company the best of luck. Like I said, I'm still going to do a lot of work on it, but this conversation has brought me very far in making my decision on potentially becoming a shareholder. So I'm not buying shares right now. I don't own any. This is, none of this is investment advice, obviously. Do your own work. Mining is very risky. You could, it's one of the riskiest things out there. So do your own work, but definitely learn from people like Doug. This was a special conversation. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandon.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.